Hey everyone, we're live now on the Conversations That Matter podcast. I'm your host, John Harris. I apologize to everyone who is waiting. I should have made more clear that this was Eastern time, and doing all these podcasts across time zones does get confusing, but we're live now. For some of you, this means your lunch break. For some of you, you're just getting up, but good morning, America. We have a special guest with us today who has not been on before, Dr. Thomas Fleming. Thank you for coming on the podcast, Dr. Fleming. Really appreciate it.
Well, it's a pleasure, John.
And I know we met, a year and a half at least, something That's like right. that ago. And you have quite the pedigree, and I can't read all of it, but Dr. Fleming is president of the Fleming Foundation. He served as the editor of Chronicles Magazine from 1984 to 2015. He is the president of the Rockford Institute, or was the president from 97 to 2014. And has written many works. And we're going to talk about a topic that I know you're very well versed in today. You told me before we started recording, you've been thinking about this for about 20 years. And that is why, I answer the question, why is it that Europeans, white people, Westerners seem to have an affection for foreigners and hate themselves? At least our elites seem to have that. And the simplistic explanations out there I've heard don't seem to make sense of it. And I know you've thought very deeply about this. So I appreciate you coming on to share your thoughts and help us explain the world we're living in.
Well, you know, it is an odd phenomenon, because if you went around the world, say, 200 or 300 years ago, and even today, if you go to rural areas, I spent a lot of time in Italy, and if you go to an Italian village, not only do they know Italy is a better country than every other country, and their region of Italy, whether it's Lombardia in the north, and I covered their separatist movement for years, or in Sicily, they know that their region is the best. And not only that, they know that their village is the best, and that their part of their village is the best. I used to know a Marxist political theorist who lived in the Abruzzo, and he said, in my town, we not only knew a foreigner, an alien, like somebody from northern Italy, but we knew a guy who walked into our neighborhood from the other side of town, because even though he was wearing the same clothes, he wore his hat a little differently, and we hated him. Now, okay, hatred isn't nice, but the fact is, if you really love who you are and who you belong to, and you love your family, you know, maybe the greatest Christian poet of all time, Dante, he refers to relatives and friends as I miei, my folks, my people, mine. Now, this is normal. This is how we're constructed by our creator, to love our own. And so when you have a whole civilization, which for about 500 years has been teaching its best and brightest to despise themselves and to look elsewhere, whether to primitive societies in Africa and South America or else to Asia, as superior, this is extraordinary. And it begins, like so many things begin in our world, it begins in the Renaissance, when people wanted to escape the power of Christianity, because, you know, priests and Lutheran ministers and Calvinists, they disagreed on a lot, but they agreed that we have a moral nature and moral obligations. For example, one man, one wife. Well, if you're a rich playboy, this isn't very attractive. So for a variety of reasons, they began looking at alternative cultures, which they celebrated and held up. For example, the great French essayist Montaigne wrote an essay on the cannibals, in which basically he says people who eat their grandmothers are morally and culturally superior to French Christians. Now, this is, you would think, preposterous, the fact that he even calls it the Essay on the Cannibals, but it's one of the most influential essays ever written in the past 500 years. Hmm. So it begins in the rebellion against Christian morality.
Now, one of the things I've seen, one of the explanations that seems a little more sophisticated, says that this all started with post-colonialism and Edward Said's, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, his essay Orientalism. But you're saying, no, this goes back way farther.
You see, Said with his Said comes up with this theory, which is a very derivative theory. He was not an original thinker at all. That Western man has an inferiority complex, so we have to go around beating up other people, yellow people, black people, brown people. It's, in his case, you know, he claimed to be Palestinian, though he had never actually lived in Palestine. Very funny. But his arguments, and then before that, it was largely a question of anti-white colonization of Africa and bringing slaves to the New World. And this was the dominant idea before Said. Before that, if you go back to the 1920s even, a group of surrealist intellectuals, they were mostly communists in France, they denounced Paul Claudel, great Christian poet and playwright who was ambassador to China. Claudel had made a statement saying that his object was to defend Christian civilization and everything in the West. The surrealists, about in the late 1920s, came up with a manifesto saying there is nothing good in the West.
I've never heard this. Wow.
Christianity is a poison, and it needs to be eradicated. And Western civilization is nothing but exploitation of people who are better than we are. Now, the thing is, these surrealists were coming in a very long tradition. But unfortunately, the idea that poor Edward Said, you know, is responsible, he was just one, the most recent in a very long chain that goes back hundreds and hundreds of years.
Does that chain start with Rousseau? Because some people will say it's Rousseau's Noble Savage that really got this going.
Rousseau's Noble Savage is important, but he is not the first Frenchman to celebrate savages. I mentioned Montaigne several hundred years earlier, and between Montaigne and Rousseau, more and more of these French intellectuals heard stories, usually phony stories, about how wonderful it was to be an Indian in North America or South America. They dropped the cannibalism bit. They found that was a little upsetting to people. And so, but writer after writer, and so it would either be American savages, or there's all these plays in, say, 17th and 18th century France, plays, poems, books, in which a Persian or Chinese comes to Paris and they write witty, ironic things about how crazy the lives of Western Christians is. And this was a very, you know, popular form of literature. Voltaire did it. Montesquieu did it. I mean, it was just a way you could show you were very clever. Some of the books, like the Persian Letters, are actually pretty funny because it's a two-edged sword. But usually the sword only cuts one way. Our world is absurd and stupid, and everyone else is smarter, better, more moral, more creative than we are. And the defense of Indians that is mounted. Look, I have no animus against the native peoples of North America. When I was growing up in northern Wisconsin, we had friends who were tribal Ojibwe. It was a fishing guide who took us everywhere. Wonderful man. But the fact is that they were almost all cannibals in the old days, and it was quite a primitive, miserable world. They had not advanced very far in agriculture. They had very few skills. And to celebrate this as superior to an advanced civilization, it's the beginning of this whole self-destructive impulse that we now see everywhere. I mean, it's the ideology of the Democratic Party.
So then, would you say this is a French project then, to this self-hating European, like did it spread from France to other places? What explains it? What are the origins of it?
It doesn't start in France, actually, but since France was the dominant cultural force in European civilization from, say, the 16th century to the early 20th century. Anything that was getting popular in France would be spread to England and then to North America. And so the French were it. If you couldn't speak French in 1850, you might as well hang it up, because you're not going to go anywhere or do anything. The French have never got over this idea that they are not only la grande nation, the great nation, but also that they are the culture bearers of Western Europe. And they deserve it. I mean, they became the great sort of spearhead first of the Renaissance and then of the Enlightenment. And basically the Enlightenment project, as it's sometimes called, says that you can't take anything for granted. Everything is open. It is up to you as the individual thinker to, first of all, eliminate all tradition, all faith, all moral givens, and then you then systematically build up the world according to what you see it as. And this is Descartes. This is the entire project of Western philosophy down to the present. Philosophy has become a very destructive discipline because it teaches children to doubt what their parents and grandparents tell them. Before you can go through a period of doubt, you have to have a period of certainty. Before you can study other cultures, you have to be at home in your own so that you have a place to stand. But where it really begins, I think, it's in Florence in the 15th century, where Florentine intellectuals began to study the occult. And when they studied the occult, like writers, these were writings that were supposed to be by ancient Egyptians, ancient Persians and Babylonians. They're really late in the Roman Empire. They're fraudulent documents. Hermes Trismegistus, the Chaldean Chronicles. It's a whole lot of junk. And they began to, this has the wisdom of the universe, and they joined it with sort of Neoplatonic speculation, but it gave them a wisdom. Whatever is true in the Bible, they would say, is true because it's imitating. Moses was in Egypt and he talked to the Egyptian priests and they taught him everything he knew. The same thing is true, they would say, of Plato. So everything goes back to the Egyptians, the builders of Solomon's temple, and to the ancient Babylonians. And therefore, our traditions are sort of bogus and derivative. And it's a very dangerous and evil project, because basically what it taught you is if you learn magic mumbo jumbo, you can escape the demons that you have to get past if you don't want to burn in hell forever. So it's a get out of hell free card if you learn this system. And how it could take over the most brilliant, intelligent people of the period, it's sort of amazing, but it does. And Florence propagates it. And then when the daughter of Lorenzo the Magnificent, the great ruler of Florence, he marries his daughter to the king of France, to the heir to the French throne, then these Florentine ideas flood into France in the late 15th, early 16th century. So if you're looking for an origin, and by the way, the same tradition, this occult tradition, it infects the whole world, because it I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but basically that's the heart of Freemasonry. In other words, that the builders of the pyramids have a secret wisdom, and that has been passed down to the Masons. And eventually, if you went up all the degrees of Freemasonry in the 18th century, you realize that all rulers were evil, all priests were evil, all Christian religion was evil, and you repudiated it. And so essentially, you became a kind of pseudo-Egyptian.
That's fascinating. I have so many questions. I'm not even sure where quite to start. And just a reminder for those who are streaming, if you have questions, get them in on X, on YouTube, on Facebook, and I will try to ask Dr. Fleming what you have. So I'm going to ask my questions first, though, since it's my show. there does seem, there's a natural proclivity people have. In fact, someone, Kiana Shaw, put, I say that my high school is the best. My class was the best. Same with my college and major, right? This is a natural human instinct.
That's right.
To say on Father's Day, my dad's the best dad, unless you had a really terrible childhood, I suppose. And that seems to be have been some disconnected from our elites in right. Western countries. So that what I'm wondering, I guess, is if you're saying this is, stems from a religious impulse that the religions of these other places are superior. Two questions wrapped up in this. Why not go back to, if you're going to do that, your own pagan roots, right? Because yeah. Europeans pre-Christian, they have their own paganism that they could appeal to. And there were people obviously who did that. And why does that also have to affect your view of your own people? So, you know, disconnected from a religion, why can't you say, well, we got religion wrong, hypothetically, but, you know, I still love my people and I want what's best for them? Because the situation we're in now, just like we're going to like give all this money to Haitians, but we can't protect the people in Appalachia. It doesn't make any sense to people.
Yeah, no, it does. And it doesn't make any sense. The a lot of it is related to the notion of a primitive man being superior to a man of advanced civilization. Now, the thing is, none of these people knows the slightest thing about how primitive people live, or about how ancient Greeks and Romans lived, or how the Egyptians lived. They invent peoples that don't exist. For example, the ancient Greeks were very religious. You know, St. Paul goes to Athens and he says, I can see you're the most religious people of all because you have a statue to all the other gods and here's one to an unknown god. Now, Paul actually got it right. These were very religious to the point of fanatically faithful people into their own religion. Families were intact. Parents were respected. All of this, and this is also true of primitive societies. But see, these people reconstructed it so originally. No, fathers don't have any control over their children after the age of 12. You can do anything you want to do. So they invent other societies that is a model for them. And the model is everybody's equal to everybody else. Everybody's the same as everybody else. There's no difference between father and son. There's no difference between man and wife. There's no difference between male and female. And you can be anything you want to become. It's like there's an old Clint Eastwood movie called Bronco Billy. And in Bronco Billy's Wild West show, you can be what you want to be. Well, if we live in a society where we think people could change their identity tomorrow, and so in such a view, and again, you attribute it to everybody else in the world but us, we have these hangups about mom and pop and grandparents and tradition and loyalties. No, we're the ones who are breaking all the rules. Primitive peoples are much, in this sense, are much smarter than we are. They honor their parents. I once saw a dumb TV show. It was Red Fox, and his son is becoming entranced with everything African, and so he insults his father in front of an African friends, and they say, "Oh, to be African, you must respect the elderly." Well, that's largely true. Our schools are designed to teach you to despise your parents, to despise authority, to despise hierarchy, and yet on the other hand, we create this artificial group we call experts. So if you pick up a daily newspaper today, hi, I'm an expert on nutrition, or I'm an expert on relationships. It is a total goofball who's he's an influencer. And he invents a resume and he starts saying preposterous things. You know, if you ate 50 eggs every day, you would live to be 300 years old. And people accept this at face value.
So what you're saying, it sounds like, is the grass is greener, first of all. There's this, when you don't understand something and you have a romanticized view of it, you tend to think it's better and superior. And it sounds like almost the dynamic that the North had after the Civil War or the war for Southern independence. I think you use that term more, but you had novels like Gone with the Wind that Northerners were buying up because they felt they had lost something in their own civilization and were looking for it. So that's kind of what you're saying, is there's this lostness that we have in the West that maybe is a result of modernity, and we're looking in these primitive societies for what we've lost.
It's not so much that we lost it, we destroyed it. Our elite classes did everything they could. For example, if you just look at family legislation from, say, the American Revolution down to World War II, in every generation, they weakened marriage, they weakened the authority of parents over children. They, you know, things like school attendance laws imply that parents don't want to do what's best for their children. The same thing with employment laws for children, but divorce laws. By the 1880s, foreign observers were saying of the United States, they have divorce on demand. Now, we think divorce on demand was invented in the 1960s. No. You realize all the northern states had, basically, you could say, my husband drinks, I don't approve of that, I want to get a divorce. So we destroy all our fundamental institutions. We destroy the family. We destroy the influence of the church. Oh, churches are fine as long as they don't meddle in politics. That's utterly preposterous. We've destroyed forms of art and music that used to give joy, and they're replaced by things that nobody in his right mind would. You know, you go to the Museum of Modern Art in New York, and it's a nightmare of horrors that they want you to look at and say, oh, that's beautiful. So we destroy everything, and then naturally you yearn for something. Now, this means there is an opening. There is an opening for people who are Christian or conservative or have a tradition, especially in the South, which is the last place where we have these traditions in the United States. And, you know, Gone with the Wind may be in some respects a silly book, but it's a very accurate book. That is I gave some lectures on this. Her depiction of the way Southerners live, their attachment to kith and kin, the way they thought of things, it's all dead on. And so it's actually a nice book to give to people so that they can read such a book or read some of Faulkner's novels or read, you know, the literature of the world gives you an image of how human life can and should be lived. And guess what? That's why they don't teach it in schools and universities. If people grew up reading the Bible, the Iliad and the Odyssey, Greek tragedy, Shakespeare, Dickens, if they had a good dose of that, they'd realize that just about everything they're taught about human life in school is wrong. That's the role literature can play. But yeah. That's what we can't. So it's very interesting. For about the past 25 years, all the Ivy League schools in America complain, and all the best universities, they can't get students to finish a book. Not a single book. When I was an undergraduate, this was sometime, you know, after, say, during the Punic Wars. When I was an undergraduate, I took a lot of French classes. And in my 19th century French novels class, we had to read a 400-500 page novel in French a week. Do you know, you couldn't get somebody to read a 400 page novel a month at Yale. Yeah. So yeah.
It's a lost art. It's yeah. a lost skill. I'm going back, and I'm sure it's worse now, but, you know, 15, well, more than that now, I guess 16 or 17 years ago in undergrad. And I took an 18th, 19th century literature course, and it was a community college. That's where I started. And we didn't read hardly any classics. It was all, they tried to pick the trashiest novels from that time. You know, we were reading like Moll Flanders. We were, we were deconstructing, Pride and Prejudice and making Frankenstein a gay novel. And I mean, it was just terrible. It was just terrible. But
that's why I tell people don't take English courses. English literature is great. My father was a great reader. And so I was reading this stuff when I was 10 years old. And so when I went to college and I had to take a one or two English courses just to for me to requirement, I can't believe people are sitting around gabbing about books that you should just read and enjoy and then move on and study something else. But now English literature and all literatures are used, if it's what you might call a book with traditional conservative values, if it's Jane Austen or Walter Scott, you either show that the author actually was meaning the opposite of what right. they read, or that the author's a moron and these people are very evil. And those are your choices. The idea that you would read Pride and Prejudice and understand that this is a beautiful depiction of social and moral relationships, oh, that's impossible. These people didn't know anything.
Yeah, yeah. I think we were told it was a feminist novel because women at that, I remember specifically, my professor said women at that time were just killed and left in the gutter and everyone would pass them by and no one would get, and I was like, where? There's no source. It's just,
yeah.
You know, Jane Austen, though, she could see and she wrote against it.
The teachers who say this probably believe it because they themselves were raised in a system where they never had to learn anything about human reality.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So we've talked about France and French intellectuals and an enamoration that some of them had with the occult or at least these ancient religions and, yeah. and this leading to this depiction of the West as inferior. And then also this longing for things that we've destroyed in other cultures. And so magnifying them. One of the observations, though, I had, and I want to get your take on this during 2020. When all the monuments were coming down, especially in the South, but it wasn't just the South. I mean, Lincoln even came down in Boston and there are Columbus statues coming down and all the rest. I noticed that controversy seemed to be unique, or at least it was more prevalent in British and British derived colonies, former British derived colonies. Yeah. So in the United States, in Great Britain, in South Africa, I think even in Australia, in Canada,
yeah.
there were these problems, and yet France, I remember, I think it was the president of France, I think it was still Macron at the time, he basically said, we're not doing any of that here.
Yeah.
And of course, they have churches burning all over the place, so maybe yeah. that's their version of that. But it just struck me that the British Empire was, I don't know if it was something intrinsic to the fact that they were an empire at one point, but they seem at that time to be more enthusiastic to take down their own traditions and their own heroes. What explains that?
That's an excellent point. What I think one of the reasons for it is that the English, the Anglo-American tradition, which is also then the same as Australia and elsewhere, early on, it developed a kind of rational, revolutionary view of human society, and which by the Whig Party, and it became known as classical liberalism. Now, I have a lot of friends who consider themselves classical liberals, libertarians, and what they believe in is that human freedom is more important than anything else. And so in order to gain human freedom, you may have to overthrow the king, overthrow churches, overthrow the authority of family, the wealth differences. Everything has to be made a level playing field. Now, that means that traditions are really just a record of oppression, you know, people denying freedom to others. And of course, this is ridiculous. I used to spend a lot of time during the wars in the Balkans, during the breakup of Yugoslavia. I was there a lot as a journalist, and I got to meet the man who claims to be king of Serbia, and he was given back his palaces and things. And I went to visit him in his palace, and he is legitimate. He's the son of the last king, and he's now given an honorary title of crown prince. And I was there with a few friends. And there were still communist monuments on his property. And of course, it was the communists who overthrew his father, destroyed Serbia. And so they asked him, well, why do you allow those communist monuments? And he said, I can't change history. History happened. It's real. And that's part of my life. And it's part of the life of my people. I can't eliminate it, even though I hate it. Now, He's maybe not the most brilliant person I've ever met, but the Crown Prince Alexander is not a moron. And he realizes that, yes, history is something that if you try to overthrow it and say it never happened, you can't learn anything from it. And you also, it means you can't honor any of your ancestors. during the French Revolution, they not only destroyed some and blew up some of the most historic churches in Paris, they also went in to one of these churches, the Church of St. Denis, and they defaced all the monuments of the early French kings because they were going to they're going to start with a blank slate, no more history. And in fact, they repudiated the very idea that they were French. They said the Franks were German invaders of a Celtic nation, and we're going to wipe out every, and the aristocracy are Franks, and the rest of us are Gauls. You know, we're like the ancient people that Julius Caesar conquered. I mean, this is, first of all, it's preposterous history because they fused about 1,000 years ago or more. So, but the goal was to wipe out the past entirely so that they could build a new future. They did the same thing during the Russian Revolution. They wiped out all these monuments of Russian history. They killed the Tsar and his family, including children. And they systematically, it was Stalin who stopped it because he realized that if you couldn't continue this and fight World War II at the same time, and you had to bring the Russian Orthodox people back into supporting the country. I mean, he had at least a lick of sense. He had more sense than our leaders who they think you can run around first and destroy all these Southern monuments. Years ago, I was asked by the Washington Post to write an article with my friend Mike Hill, who started the League of the South. And basically, the article was on why the destruction of Southern monuments is defined by international law as cultural genocide. And that's what we're doing. And I said in the article, Some of the evil Southern slaveholders are named George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, James Monroe, the founders of this country that we, if you want to honor the United States, you can't go around destroying monuments to the South. And that I said, the day will come when everybody's monuments, if you ever had a house servant, or if you ever got into a quarrel with an Indian, you're going to be dismissed from the historical record. And of course, it happened. But yeah. this hatred of the past. If you have a blank slate, that means you can make people do anything you want to do. You reinvent human nature, and that's what Marx said. Marx said, "Man is the only creature who makes his own essence." In other words, we other creatures are determined. A bear grows up to be a bear. A dog is a dog, but we can be anything. We can redefine ourselves. And so in the Soviet Union, that's what they tried to do. They redefined human society, human nature. You don't need extended family. You don't need property. You don't need social hierarchy. And in the end, a tiny part of the population, like 0.1%, owned and controlled everything. And that is exactly what goes on when you destroy your past in the name of liberation of minorities. No minority is getting anything out of this. It's only the people who own the country. They're the one who get everything.
Yeah. Well, on that note, I would like to ask another question of you, because this is another narrative that I hear sometimes. And I see some people in the comments. One person said that Montaigne was Jewish. So half Jewish. Okay. So you talk about communism and this ideology. And I guess my own opinion, which maybe doesn't matter since I have you on the show, but just for people who are listening, who care, I think there's an ideological angle to this that's not specific to necessarily even Marxism, but more broadly speaking, ideology itself does this kind of flattening and eliminates tradition in the past. Yeah. But anyway, people will say, if you're talking about communism, Marxism, you're talking about a Jewish project. If you're talking about European, you know, anti-white hatred or whatever, you're also talking about a Jewish project. These things are linked. And it's because essentially Jewish people lived as minorities in these places. And there's a lot of resentment, and they want revenge because of the way they were treated. And so they're going to become the elites. They have strong in-group preferences. They're going to control things. And then that explains, a lot of guys online think that explains all the anti-white hatred that exists, which I don't necessarily see that, but I'm wondering, okay, so is that a contributing influence though? Are there Jewish people who feel this way and are trying to fuel this kind of thing?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question, and it's easy to go off the deep end on any question, because there's no area of human life where you could say, and it's the trouble with conspiracy theories, they make things very simple.
Right.
The fact that Montaigne was half Jewish probably is important to his dislike of Christianity, and he supported King Henry IV, who was indifferent to religion. He was a Protestant who, when he said, they said, look, become Catholic and you're king. And he said, well, Paris is worth a mass. You know, I mean, a complete cynic. I found a reference to of an English traveler that I spent Easter with the king. We celebrated the Eleusinian mysteries. I mean, the guy was an occultist. So anyway, my point is that the movement was not primarily started by Jewish people. However, it is also true that some of what people say is right. I mean, that Jews feel uncomfortable in societies run by non-Jews, just as Christians would feel uncomfortable in a society run by Muslims. Say, Middle Eastern Christians really have access to grind both against the state of Israel and against Islam. And so they've been recruited over and over, but they are not the intellectual leaders who created this. These are largely ex-Christians who we have to learn to accept the responsibility ourselves. Sure, Jews have been recruited. I mean, Marx was Jewish. Lenin was at least partly Jewish. Trotsky was Jewish. But then you have to look at all of the great lefty revolutionary thinkers of the past 300 years, and Jews are only a small minority. And by the way, not the most important thinkers. Marx is a very derivative, second-rate thinker. You can see where he gets all his ideas from, and it's not from Jewish people. So there's an interesting man in Russia, great mathematician, was a friend of Solzhenitsyn, Igor Shafarevich. I had the pleasure of having dinner with him in Moscow. And Shafarevich is hated by the CIA. They claim he's an anti-Semite because he wrote a book called Russophobia. And Russophobia is about, in Russia, the same thing that we're talking about today, Russian self-hatred of their own traditions. And he wrote a book, very smart book, tracing it. And, you know, about a third of the people he talks about are Jewish. And so he's accused. I've read the book. And it's funny because they don't publish a translation. But a friend of mine in the CIA gave me a copy of the book. Man. So I could read it in English. And in fact, it's a very sober, sensible book. And he never blames the Jews. But he points out that this tradition of Russian liberalism means we Russians don't come from this, like, we're not French. We have our peasant traditions. We are deeply Orthodox. We have all sorts of patriarchal traditions. And if you compare us to France and England, well, we're very primitive people. And so the writer after writer, intellectual after intellectual, political leader after political leader adopted this point of view, which makes the Russians seem petty and stupid and primitive. And of course, there were Jewish writers who subscribed to it. The Jews didn't invent Russophobia. They latched onto it, but they didn't invent it. And it's time to quit. Yeah, hold everybody responsible for what he does. But there's no point in trying to shift the burden off ourselves because we're responsible. Post-Christians have done this to us.
Yeah, I actually, there was a Twitter thing a few weeks ago where people were saying basically all the immigration problems, it's all Jewish. It's a Jewish project in America. And so I just asked a simple question. Who let these Jews in?
Yeah.
You know, because at the beginning, I think I was looking at a census from 1790, and I think it said 500, probably Sephardic Jews.
Yeah.
Probably in South Carolina mainly, were in the country. And I'm thinking, so, you know, obviously the immigration policy was crafted by Anglos, you know, from the beginning. So,
And by the way, You know, a lot of the South Carolina Jews were very loyal during the war. You know, Bernard Baruch, who was the richest man in America in the 1930s, a big advisor of Franklin Roosevelt, and obviously a Sephardic Jew, his father was a physician, but he signed up for the Confederate Army. And after the war, he even joined the Ku Klux Klan. There were...
Wow. Okay.
Life.
Talk about narratives not working. Clashing there. Well, was it? Who was the guy? Moses Ezekiel, right? He was Jewish, and yeah, they just took his statue from Arlington, and then Judah P. Benjamin was the Treasury Secretary of the Confederacy. Right. Different wave of immigrants, though, because
one of the things that's interesting is I grew up in Charleston. I was born in the north, but I grew up down there, and I noticed that Italians, Jews, Irish, who are often very troublesome in northern cities. That is, the Irish with their potato famine rhetoric, the Jews with how we've suffered, the Sicilians very clannish. In Charleston, they were all Charlestonians. They were aggressively Charlestonian,
right?
Aggressively pro-Southern. And they very little of this, and this was very clear. Again, in Gone with the Wind, they're Irish. I mean, the Scarlett O'Hara, Irish Catholics, but they're ferociously loyal to the South. And it's the difference between a urban liberal Unitarian culture, which was New England, and a rooted culture, which can transform immigrants. A certain degree of immigration can be healthy as long as they become, in the first generation, artificial, in this case, Americans. But if you don't have the mechanisms, if you don't have the mechanisms of church and family and local pride, then they just become disruptive. Like all these Germans who came to the North after the Revolution of 1848, they were all left-wing revolutionaries.
Right.
So Carl Schurz, who becomes the first Secretary of the Interior, his wife starts the first kindergarten in Wisconsin. I mean, all these terrible German ideas that came in here through them. But in the South, like in Texas, more Germans per capita signed up for the Confederate Army than anybody else. And the same thing was true in South Carolina. The Germans were very loyal.
That region. Regionalism is fascinating to me, and I know that's not the subject of our discussion exactly, but it does seem that immigrant groups who traveled south at early stages in our republic behaved differently,
yes,
and integrated better for some reason. And there was this tradition that they tapped into and contributed to. And whereas, I mean, I live about an hour and a half north of New York City, so the Ellis Island reality is very clear here. And you know, my wife and I will even say, like, you know. And this isn't true across the board, but we've noticed things just from living. I haven't studied this, but I've just noticed if you go to the town north of me, Kingston, New York, that's about the northernmost, like that's where the Italians stop, right? Because the Italians tend to travel with each other. Yeah. It seems like more so grandma and grandpa's there, and they just, and so you get north, you go to Albany, and there's not as many Italians. There's some, but you know, it's less and less. Whereas like the Irish people who came, oh, they just like spread out everywhere. Like it's just cultural things. But they did retain their European identities much more strongly, it seems to me, at least, and not becoming as much American. Maybe that's because of the high volume of people we brought in. I don't know, but
it's volume, but it's also a powerful culture. It forces people to assimilate because it's an attractive thing to do. Whereas a culture that's sort of just based on money and on abstract principles of equality and all of that, it doesn't work that much. I think even in the in small town Midwest, people assimilated much better than they did in the big city Midwest. So say Chicago versus some town of 1,000. And like, for example, I know a fair amount about different like Sicilians and Serbs. And I noticed that that Chicago Serbs are very clannish. They think of themselves as Serbs who live in America, even after two or three generations. Whereas I've met Serbs from Southern Illinois who went down there to work in the mines they think of themselves as Americans.
Yeah. Yeah. Fascinating. Well, I have a million questions, but I need to get to some of these questions from the audience. Let me do this one first, just because I think this one's for me and I think the rest are for you. So someone says I made a stupid argument about immigration. I'll just say that I'm not saying that Anglos are to blame for all immigration policy. I was just saying, like, you can't have one ideological explanation for the whole and say, well, it's all Jews and just leave it at that. And you don't ever actually study the issue. And it's a combination of many factors that have led us to the area that we're in. And history's like that. There's so many converging forces.
It's like feminism. Who gave women the vote?
Not women.
No, they had no power. They had no political power. So
it was Jews. No, I'm just kidding.
Men are the problem.
Right. All right. So here's some questions for you, Dr. Fleming. Is the Enlightenment impulse to question the received or accepted narrative a useful perspective when surrounded by the narrative creators? I don't get this question. Creators surrounding us today. Let me read this again. Is the Enlightenment impulse to question the received or accepted narrative a useful perspective? Oh, I see. Okay, I see what he's saying. Yeah. Do you understand the question?
In other words, if skepticism is what destroyed civilization, don't we need skepticism today? And the answer is, this is very interesting.
Of the skeptics, right.
Yeah, and I meet all these people who say they're religious skeptics. I said, have you ever thought about questioning your own skepticism? I mean, because you're using certain fundamental assumptions that you hold as unassailable. Well, let's look at them. And it can be useful. The problem is when you simply adopt the technique of your enemy, you become just like your enemy. And so while using skepticism, you should always at the same time be rooting and regrounding yourself in your own tradition. And that's why studying the history, studying the literature, studying the traditions which we have going back to the ancient Greeks, that is more important even than adopting a skeptical position about everything you're told today. Because in the end, it's what you learn positively. It's what you learn to love, not what you learn to hate that will define you. But it was a good point, an excellent point.
Good, great wisdom. Yeah. Here's another question for you, Dr. Fleming. Please ask about the troublesome prevalence of Masonry in Southern circles.
It's an interesting thing.
I'm not familiar.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I've read about Masonry, and I know in the South. Go ahead.
Freemasonry came to America. You know, Washington was a Mason. Jefferson was a Mason. Lafayette was a Mason. When they laid out the D.C., Washington, D.C., and they put the foundation stone of the Capitol, they had a Masonic parade led by Washington wearing a Masonic apron sewn by Madame de Lafayette. I mean, you could look at a dollar bill and it's just Masonic imagery. So from the beginning, but these were Scottish Rite Masons. They were sort of naive. They were not like the French Masons, quite different. It's a dangerous movement in any event, but the American version of it was much until recently was much less dangerous because it emphasizes brotherhood and that they would argue you can be a good Christian and a good Mason. But then why do you have two separate burials, for example? If you're a Catholic Mason, you have a Catholic funeral, and then the Masons have a Masonic funeral for you. During the war between the states, there was in Louisiana, there was the day the war stopped. Because they wanted to arrange a Masonic burial of a Union officer off a ship on the Mississippi. So it is a problem, but most of the Southern Masons, like most of the old Yankee Masons, were pretty decent, solid people. You joined the Masons largely for social and economic reasons. Nonetheless, when you have a church, why do you need the Masons? Today, a lot of the Masons have got, like, leading sort of intellectual Masons have actually been going back to France and reestablishing ties with revolutionary Masonry, and it's becoming dangerous again. I think the Southern Baptists still condemn all Masonic affiliation, or at least they did when there were still really Southern Baptists left in America.
Yeah, there's much more I would want to say, but I want to be respectful of your time. We have more questions. John says, good morning, Dr. Fleming. I have followed and read you since the beginning of Chronicles Magazine. I've always appreciated your paleoconservatism, and I have, I think modeled is what he meant to say, modeled my life after your insights. That's very high praise.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. Elisa says, question. So, is this also why many feel like going back to simple times, seeking the old days? I think this is back in our discussion when we were talking about Gone with the Wind and so forth. Is it running away from the reality or a real need to go back to the way things were?
She raises this is a serious question, because there's what you might call the Amish temptation. You know, since everything in the modern world has gone to hell, then we should then dress like we should wear. I go to a church where I see a lot of people that the girls dress like they're in the Little House on the Prairie episode, and they don't bathe as often, perhaps, as they might. And they, you know, they're going to get off the grid and all of that. I don't think this is especially dangerous, but it's also not especially practical. You have to deal in the world that you're living in. When Christianity came along, in the earliest period of the Christians, you see, like, for example, there's a great apology written about 100 AD, in which is, we don't dress funny, we don't act funny, we're good citizens, we're good neighbors, we set an example to people. And all we do is, men don't make love to men, and we don't kill our children, that's how we're different. But other than that, we're normal people. And I think that if you could buy a farm and live out on it and be self-sufficient, great. But very few people are qualified or really want to do that ultimately. But to reject the bad things, for example, you can quit watching network television, you can quit watching NFL games, you can quit watching Hollywood movies. And this doesn't mean you can't watch a movie from 1935, or you can quit looking at internet porn and you can watch this podcast. I mean, there are a lot of things you could do with modern technology. Now, if I had my choice, yeah, I'd do away with everything. But that's not, I never wanted to drive a car. But when I got married, I could hardly see my marriage beginning with my wife driving away from the church. So I could drive a car, and I had to get a license. There are things you have to do to put up with the world you live in. Otherwise, for example, if you repudiate air travel, I can't go to Italy, which I'm doing in 2 weeks for a month. There are a lot of things you can't do. For example, it's hard to buy you can't afford to buy books anymore, but you can get a lot of free or very low priced books through various services online. So take what's important is to develop a question of a core. What is it you really believe? What is it you really want? Avoid the bad things. Like, for example, don't go to McDonald's. Does that mean you're going to quit eating food? Mm. You know, pornography and promiscuous sex is bad, does that mean you shouldn't get married and you should just be celibate? You have to take the basic human needs and the basic facts of human society and our basic needs and find ways of accommodating them in a world which admittedly is going to hell in a handbasket. But you can make the best of a bad situation. And by the way, that's all humanity is ever able to do.
Great advice. Great advice. Where do Democrats get their white people don't have a culture narrative, asks Christy.
That is funny, because they get it because they don't have a culture narrative. That is, the Democrats saying that have no knowledge of history, culture, tradition. And they just, I remember reading something by Jack Kerouac, who's not the worst American writer, even though he's actually French-Canadian. But he says, I walk down the street and I'm, oh, if only I could be a Negro, a Jew, a honky, a hunky, a Italian instead of just a white guy. And James Baldwin, the black novelist, said, I wouldn't say those things in my neighborhood. But the point is that when we have stripped away our symbols, our culture, repudiated our tradition, when, you know, once upon a time, like even in my childhood, which is admittedly the 1950s, you had to read Shakespeare to graduate from high school. You had to read 4 plays. Now, that's not a lot. You should have had to read 20, but or at least 10. But the fact is, nobody reads Shakespeare. Nobody reads Milton. Nobody reads Homer. Nobody. We have no knowledge of our, and we don't know any of our history. And our, you know, we used to have Independence Day. Now it's July 4th, which sounds like some revolutionary holiday. Hmm. You get rid of your institutions and your traditions. Well, of course, it looks like you have no cultural narrative. In fact, we have the most brilliant and powerful cultural narrative in the history of the human race. And it goes back to the Old Testament and it goes back to Homer. Even the Chinese, who have very long and deep cultural traditions, would have a hard time keeping up with us.
Good point. When Christianity was in political ascendancy, Jews were being run out of Christian countries and states. Why? Man, I'll let you take as long as you want. I think I told you we were going to do an hour. We're at 55 minutes, but I'll let you take as long as you want with that.
Sure. Well, first of all, there were periods in which Jews were expelled from various places. Often, like in England, the Jews were persecuted because they loaned the king money and then he didn't want to pay it back. So when Jews were allowed to be money lenders in the Middle Ages, when Christians were forbidden. And so usually in the more civilized parts of Europe, like Italy and France and most of England and in Scotland, Jews were not allowed the same privileges as Christians because, for example, well, why weren't they allowed to go to universities? Because universities are primarily places for the clergy and for training a Christian clergy, first Catholic and then Protestant clergy. If you can't go to Oxford, you couldn't be a student, much less a professor at Oxford or Cambridge, unless you were a professing Christian. So they found they had, and even later on, Catholics couldn't go because you had to be an Anglican. So every society has not only the right to make its own rules and decide who is qualified for which position, but it has the duty to do that. It's got a duty to say what women can do, what men can do, what children can do, what citizens can do, what aliens can do. And so do people abuse that kind of authority all the time because we're human? Do pastors do they abuse their ability? Sure, everybody does, because we're imperfect creatures. But that doesn't mean that these traditions and responsibilities are wrong. Hmm.
Question, what is the best introductory book on paleoconservatism?
Don't waste your time on that. I mean, look, I think
I have your book that you did with Paul Gottfried.
Yeah, they might start with that. We invented the term. Yeah. We were sitting around with a great Burke scholar, Peter Stanlis, and we were talking about the neoconservatives. And so Peter Stanlis said, well, what does that make us? Paleolithic? You know, like we're Stone Age? And I said, yeah, we're paleocons. So it's a difficult book, but I'd read my first book, The Politics of Human Nature, because in that I tried to argue, we're not just talking about traditions. We're not just talking about faith or belief. We're talking about the way humanity is constructed, how we have to live. We can't live productively by pretending men are women or that the family isn't the essence of society. So when I and my friends used the term, we meant it a political view based on the reality of human nature as revealed through human history.
Big Yehuda says you should call it the Neanderthal, right? I don't think that's going to catch on.
No, I don't think so. The Neanderthals are not very attractive people. The thing about human nature is the same everywhere. The basics, but that's like saying, you know, that two pianos are the same, but when I play the piano and when a great pianist plays the piano, it's different. So different societies have evolved and created very beautiful things with art and music and philosophy and theology, all sorts of wonderful stuff. And it's not Neanderthal.
You know, I was having a discussion with someone yesterday. I'm wondering if you would agree with this, who I had made a statement online that, you know, ideology isn't compatible with conservatism. And then this person wanted me to explain myself. And I was thinking about neoconservatism, and I was thinking, like, you know, it's basically like I mean, there's all these other inputs, like you have liberalism and classical liberalism and so forth, but it seems like it's a freeze frame. Like it's a universal freeze frame that they say, like, these principles, these 10 things here, you know, free markets and strong defense and, you know, whatever, get your list together. That's conservatism for all times and places.
Yeah.
And the thing about real, like, paleoconservatism, which you're talking about, is like the thing that doesn't change isn't the principles that you apply necessarily in a political context. It's human nature that doesn't change. That's and right. The situations do change and the policy prescriptions do change and the issues you focus on do change. So it's very circumstantial and definitive, not universal. Yeah. I don't know if I'm just curious if you'd agree with that.
You're absolutely right. Look, there used to be, you know, the great tradition of ethics from Aristotle to Cicero to Thomas Aquinas to some of the great German Protestants and great English Protestants. This tradition where they say, yeah, we have a rule, but then how you apply that rule varies from person to person, from situation to situation. And you've got to understand that. You can't, you know, okay, it's wrong to kill a fellow human being. Well, what about if he's trying to kill me? Well, that's something. Well, what if he's sleeping with my wife? Well, that's something. Well, what if I'm temporarily crazed? Well, that's something. The point is, you have a basic principle, but you understand that its implementation is not simplistic. So something like free trade, you know, there are periods. If you dominate the world economy, free trade is great because then you bust open everybody else's markets and you can grab all the goodies for yourself. But when you're competing with a large number of other powerful economies whose leaders cheat, and we're cheated outrageously by the European Union, by the Chinese, then free trade, you say, well, what do you want is a trade policy that benefits your country.
Right.
And so if you start saying, well, I'm a radical free trader and I believe in open borders, none of these things are absolutes. And so an ideology takes things that are relatively true under certain circumstances, and it, as you say, it freeze frames them. It makes them a static thing that works forever, and nothing in human life is like that.
Yeah, yeah. All right, I appreciate the vote of confidence there. I said the right thing. All right, this is the last question. This is the last question because I want to be respectful of Dr. Fleming's time here. Daryl Dow asked, Dr. Fleming was a longtime friend of the late Sam Francis. Does he have thoughts about Francis's framework of the Middle American Revolution and whether it has relevance to current politics?
It does and it doesn't. The obviously, Sam and I had known each other even since graduate school. I didn't know him well, but we had lunch and met a couple of times then. And we were involved politically for a long time. Sam believed that there was that Middle America, that is parts of the South, the West, and the Midwest, were basically being ruled and exploited by people on the two coasts who were not overeducated, but they were overschooled. And they had simply monopolized all power and were exploiting the rest of us, and that periodically the Middle American radical element would rebel, sometimes on the right, sometimes on the left, but the populist movement, the progressive movement, all of the Wallace movement, all of these things could be seen as Middle American uprisings. The trouble today is every new generation of Americans is less educated, but also has less knowledge of the real world. They can't plant a tomato, they can't fix a car, they can't hunt, they can't, you know, great Hank Williams Jr. song about the Middle American types is, I can skin a buck and I can run a trot line because a country boy can't survive. How many of those country boys are left? When I go back south, what I see is a bunch of bubbas living in trailers and running meth labs. So a lot of the element, the core element of what would be the Middle American Revolution has been rotted out. And on the other hand, a lot of them are suckers for things like Fox News and other really completely implausible sets of liars that you get in the media. Tucker Carlson, Carlson, you know, is a pampered member of the old elite. His father has worked for the Council on Foreign Relations. Good grief. But if you fall for these gurus and talk show hosts, and you write nasty things on the internet all day long, you're not going to fight a revolution that way. And what we need is to restore some of the sanity that used to be in Middle America, in Middle American families and communities. But as long as they keep watching the TV, that's not going to happen.
Man, that is such a good point. We should probably just end the podcast with that, because that's I want that to sink in on people, because I've seen these conspiracies and just things that you can't do anything about practically with your like limited time that we have as humans, and people get sucked in and they'll spend days and weeks and years of their lives devoted to things that aren't really productive. And so thank you for making that point that we need to be more productive.
The old serenity prayer, Jesus, give me the serenity to accept what I cannot change. You can't control who's president. You can't control who's governor. You probably can't even control who's mayor. You can put your own life in order. And that's the place to begin.
All right. With that, thank you, Dr. Thomas Fleming. If you want to find out more about Dr. Thomas Fleming's work, you can go to fleming.foundation. And there's a number of resources there. Is there anywhere else you'd like me to send people, Dr. Fleming?
No, that'll be a good gateway.
Okay. All right. Sounds good. God bless. Have a good day.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.